Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for coming here this afternoon at the end of the session. I see a lot of friends in the audience, so thanks to all of you and everyone else. Hopefully I'll get a chance to meet you after this. So again, my name is Mitch Hunter. I'm a PhD candidate in agronomy at Penn State, and I'll be talking about agriculture in 2050, recalibrating targets for sustainable intensification. So this is the sustainable intensification research symposium, or the symposium of this morning. These are the panel of talks. This is the audience that I really want to have hear this message. And I think the talks this morning really covered a lot of the issues, critiques of sustainable intensification, as well as the many ways that it's contributing to our thinking about the future of agriculture. And I want to build on those, and I also want to pick up on a question that was asked in the Q&A, which was, can this community be the group that brings together the changes that need to happen at the farm scale, the field scale, and the landscape scale to make this happen? And I hope that that can be the case. And I also think that before we get to that more ultimate goal, what we can do right now is change the narrative. And that really is, I think, an urgent need, is to change the narrative of what we mean by sustainable intensification. So that's what I'll be talking about primarily today. I want to acknowledge co-authors and reviewers, many of whom are in the room right now, so thanks to all of you for help along the way with this project, as well as funding from USDA and NSF. And there's been a lot of talk already today about what is sustainable intensification. Not to rehash it, but my very brief definition is that we need to produce more food while reducing environmental impacts on an equal or lesser amount of land as development continues and as we try to avoid converting natural lands, while at the same time climate change makes our production challenges even more difficult in many cases. And I think this is the right direction. I mean, there's a lot of argument about what sustainable intensification means, if this is what we should be doing. Generally, I think it's hard to argue with this is our challenge. But I think there's a big unanswered question. How far do we need to go in each, especially of the top two arrows? How much more food do we need to produce? And how low does our environmental impact need to go? Those, I think, are the big challenges those are the questions we need to answer, and those are the questions that shape the narrative that goes out beyond rooms like this. So I would argue that our 2050 targets are way out of whack, and so this is the narrative that we need to change. Where we are now, we see across the literature very frequently people call for a 60 to 100% increase in food production, both in the studies that came up with these numbers and as these figures are used to justify future work. And I think this gets translated into the simple notion that we need to double food production. And this is really what dominates the broader narrative. So just to give you some examples, we see that in the popular press, so National Geographic. We see that from industry. We see that from our own society, American Society of Agronomy, and in high-profile scientific publications. So this even goes to the point where this doubling notion gets translated into a graph, and values for yield today are just doubled to suggest where we need to go in 2050. And I think this the dominance of this doubling narrative really has some nefarious effects on our understanding of what needs to happen, because it implies, if you say we need to double food production, of course it implies that we double it from today, that today is the baseline, and we go forward and double it. And, you know, that graph in the bottom right is an example of that way of translating the notion of doubling. In contrast to that, and I'll go into the details, but simply by going back to the main projections of food demand and reanalyzing that data, updating it in a couple of important ways, our analysis shows that we only need to increase food production roughly 25 to 70%. And, okay, 70, 100, there's a lot of uncertainty in these numbers when you go out 35 years. I think this has really important implications, though, for how we think about the way agriculture is going to progress. And on the other side of the equation, with the environmental impacts, broadly speaking, environmental goals in this literature of sustainable intensification are either vague or just completely absent. So to give a few examples of how we talk about environmental improvements, Garnett et al. Have maybe one of the more aggressive ones, where they say that we need to achieve major reductions in environmental impact. That suggests that we're here and we go down here. Okay, so at least we know what direction we're heading. Our society uses more general language, so we want to use resources more efficiently. We want to enhance environmental quality in a variety of ways. And then maybe the most egregious example, and this is not to pick on Monsanto because a lot of people get caught in this paradox, where we say we want to improve sustainability or reduce resource use or environmental impact per unit, at the same time that we say we're going to double the amount of units that we're creating. So just because you reduce impact on water, let's say, by 30%, if you then double the number of units, we're actually going to be polluting more. So how is this fall under the umbrella of sustainable intensification if it's in fact increasing impacts on the environment? So in contrast to this, these vague goals, I think we need clear targets, and the aim should be to maintain functional ecosystems, not to return to completely pristine states. We know that's not going to happen. But I think we should base our goals around levels that we think can be, if we hit them, would actually allow us to have functional ecosystems that we could depend on. And we need to get away from just saying, oh, we're going to be more sustainable, or talking about marginal improvements that may not reduce impacts in the aggregate. So to get into the food demand projections in a little more detail, so you understand where these are coming from, there are really two main projections in the literature that are widely cited. One is from FAO, and kind of the headline takeaway from them is that we need to increase food production by 60% by 2050, although that's from a baseline that's 10 years old. And it's also based on a price-weighted production index. So this is not really the amount of food, this is how much we're going to spend on food in 2050. And the other one, the other study that's widely cited, is from Tillman et al. From 2011, and they found that we need to produce 100% more calories and 110% more protein by 2050. And they also use a baseline that's about 10 years old. This is also exclusively from human edible crops, so they didn't include forages and that sort of thing. There are many other projections, but they all fall out along similar lines. Most of them are very similar to FAO, and there's kind of a raft of those, and then Tillman sits out more on its own. So why is there such a large discrepancy between these two, 60%, 100%? Well, you've got the price weighting, but you also have differences in GDP growth rates and projection methods that I can't go into in great detail. And I think, importantly, FAO accounts for the potential saturation of meat consumption in China, where, you know, per capita income is still relatively low, but meat consumption is very high, and cultural factors in India that might limit the amount of that meat consumption will grow. So the two largest countries on Earth may not be responding to GDP as far as their meat consumption in the same way that our country has, let's say. So what we did is to update these food demand projections, and we use cereals as a proxy because if anything more complex is really challenging, cereals are also the world's dominant crop. They represent 63% of calories from human edible crops, 56% of protein. And so to do this, we just were able to take the FAO projection directly. They have a projection of cereal demand in addition to their top-line projection, and that shows only a 46% increase. So I think that's what we were hearing from the previous speaker, from 2005, 2007 to 2050. With Tillman et al., we didn't have a direct projection from them, so we just had to approximate that by doubling cereal production from 2005 to 2050. We also updated both of these projections for the most recent population projections. So they were done, the studies were done in the past. We now project slightly higher populations in 2050. So we transformed the levels that they projected to meet a higher global population. And just for context, we're at 7.4 billion today, and the projection in the middle projection is for 9.7 billion in 2050. So here's how this comes out. If we actually look at how many tons of cereals do we produce, and how many more we projected to have to produce. So this is the historical line, and what you can see is that in the last 11 years, cereals production has increased substantially worldwide. So we've already moved the needle 24%. Now, has all of this intensification been sustainable? Obviously not. In this case, much of the increase has come from yield gains, but it's also come from expansion of area under cereals, which can have some major environmental implications, as well as intensification on that land. So to meet the FAO projection from the current level, or the 2014 level, which is the most recent data, we only need to increase 26% more as far as cereals production. So this is essentially the bottom of the range of our projection of food demand in 2050 and the increase we need. Now, if we go from essentially the Tillman projection, or doubling from 2005, you can see it's a much steeper growth curve, and that is equivalent to a 68% increase from today. So that range of 26 to 68% is essentially what we believe to be the bounds based on the literature that exists of what food demand will be in 2050. Now, if we're gonna double from today, which is what people imply when they just go out there and say we need to double food production, the rate of increase is substantially higher. So we're on this much steeper trajectory, a trajectory you can see far steeper than anything we've achieved in the last few decades. So I think that the implication of that is that in this whole sustainable intensification balance, intensification is going to win. There's no way that we can meet that kind of rapid increase in food demand while simultaneously drastically reducing our environmental impacts. I don't see the method that we have in front of us right now. That sounds very challenging. And I think focusing on this kind of growth really just provides a lot of backing for the narrative that more production is the way to get to our goals. Both our production goals and our environmental goals, what we need to do is intensify, which is really, in my mind, doing more of the same. So we have a new word for essentially what we've been doing since the beginning of the Green Revolution. And I don't think that's what sustainable intensification should mean. I think it can be a term that helps us make the sorts of changes we need. Another example of this is that, okay, we've got 25 to 70%. Maybe that's a more manageable goal. And that's a good thing. We should be happy that our food demand projections are maybe lower than what we thought. Because to meet those higher projections will be really hard. So this is the compound annual rate of world cereal yield growth. And you can see that it's been declining. So to meet the Tillman projection, essentially, that would need to be sustained at 1.5% for the next 35 years. So something that we haven't been able to do consistently since the 1980s, we'll have to get back to that level and sustain it. To double from where we are today, we'd have to be even higher and have a compound yield growth rate that we haven't seen at all since maybe the early 80s, and that even before that was hard to maintain during the heyday of industrialization and improvement of cropping systems. So I think hitting those higher goals is going to be very challenging, and we should all be happy that we have a more manageable goal to shoot at. So I want all of you, it's an intimate group, but I need you all to be the disciples so that the next time you hear someone saying we need to double food production, you say, well, I'm sorry, but the data doesn't back that up. In fact, we need to increase food production maybe a quarter to three quarters from where we are now. Don't say doubling. I think doubling is a really misleading way to talk about food production, you know, assuming that you're talking about the year 2050. Yes, population will continue to grow, GDP will continue to increase. Now we're getting into the future that we just are irresponsible if we're trying to project what's going to happen at that point. The good news is that for food production, we're on the right trajectory. We're really good at increasing the amount of food we produce, right? So at least we're heading in the right direction. And that's really positive because with new challenges coming down the pike, we may have to run just a standstill on that front. Okay, so moving on to the environmental goals. I'm going to do these pretty rapidly because I think Cameron is squirming. I'm getting short on time. So I'm going to look at greenhouse gas emissions and Mississippi River nutrient pollution, just as examples. Obviously, there are many more issues to be addressed. So for greenhouse gas emissions, the most widely cited goal is for an 80% reduction. Historically, the emissions from agriculture have been increasing. This does not include deforestation. This is just direct emissions. And FAO projects that under business as usual, they'll keep going up at about the same rate. Now, this is what an 80% reduction looks like. Extremely drastic and scary. I don't know how to meet that today by 2050. That's going to be a huge challenge. But before that makes you step back and say, well, forget this, I'm not into sustainable intensification anymore, I think we should recognize that this is what our entire economy needs to do by 2050. And if anything, the rest of the economy and the world is going to look at agriculture as a place to stuff some extra carbon in our soils. So we may need to go negative in order to make up for some other systems that are even more difficult to reduce emissions in. Now for Mississippi River nitrogen and phosphorus, I'm showing phosphorus data because the nitrogen has some complexities to it. There's a goal for a 45% reduction from this baseline average to restore or just really to shrink the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, not to eliminate it. And we can see that there's a very noisy trend that shows some increase in phosphorus. And to hit that goal, again, we really have to change the trajectory dramatically to get down to where we need to be. So for environmental goals, unlike crop production, where at least we're headed in the right direction, here we're still headed in the wrong direction, and we have a huge challenge to try to change that trajectory and get going in the right direction. And that's what we need to do going forward. So I don't have the solutions to all this. Here we have the two laid out next to each other, but I'm going to skip ahead to here. I don't have the solutions to how we get, solve this dual challenge by 2050. I think that's why we have this community, to try to figure out how to do that. But I think the first thing we need to do is change the narrative. We write these papers, they get picked up by industry, they get picked up by government, and they're going to do whatever they want with the things that we say. We can't control that. But I think as the scientific community, we need to stand on firm ground on the data that we have to back up our notion of what sustainable intensification means. And I don't think it means doubling food production from where we are today if we don't have data that back that up. And I don't think it means marginal improvements in environmental impact or per unit improvements that actually result in more environmental impact. I don't think we can accept either of those definitions, and it's on us, because nobody else is going to do it, to stand up and say, sorry, that's not sustainable intensification. Converging on a single definition is going to be hard, but we should be able to be vocal about what is not sustainable intensification, and I hope that's what this community can help do. So I have a couple more points, but I'm just going to skip through them and try to stop. And thank you all. I'm happy to take questions. That's very depressing. Thanks. No, you're right. You're absolutely right. I'm not laying out an actionable vision. That's pretty clear. We don't have political will. We don't have political will to do things that benefit us today, like reducing nutrient pollution to waterways that affect fisheries, that affect recreation opportunities, much less the things that are probably going to affect us or benefit us most 50 years down the road. I guess I feel like there's many paths towards making this kind of change, and the path that I've chosen is to try to better understand what the challenges are and to communicate those and figure out little ways to get there. And then ultimately has to happen at a political level where you have masses of voters who care about these issues. And I hope that that happens during my career, my lifetime. Yeah. Adam? It would look much easier. There's no question. And I think if I were to add a slide of what are the things that we're going to do that we could do to meet this, major dietary change would be one of them. Absolutely. I think it greatly reduces the amount of increase, or we may not even need to increase production, even to meet very high populations. And that just opens up space to meet these other goals. So space on the landscape where we can devote land to other functions, to cleaning up waterways, to sequestering carbon, to all of the improvements that we'd like to make, or simply to de-intensifying on the lands that are devoted to crop production in a way that we don't need to maximize yield of the highest yielding crop in every single year. So there's no question, I think, kind of to turn you back to the previous questioner, it's another question of how we get there, and I think it's the same answer, which is education and waiting for the slow turnover of of social norms to try to meet that. Question in the back. Absolutely. I mean, I think if this was the U.S. Senate right here, we would have a much different political system. Or yes, definitely political system, but I meant agricultural system. Yeah, Nick?
So that observation raises the interesting question of whether a tri-society community would be interested in gaining political agency, and how that thought sits with the norms that we have been with as scientists. And I wonder how I'm not an enrolled member of that community, but I wonder how this group would think about that. So there would be some distinct behaviors, I think, that would go along with an active effort to change the narrative that would be could be sort of a project that could be undertaken by this community. However, that would be quite different from the typical behavior of a community, I think. And so I think you, Mitch, I think you've given us a very interesting challenge about, how, what are these tri-society communities sort of good for? What contributions can they make that are, unique in the ecosystem, as it were?
Yeah, are we just a talking shop, or can we turn it into something? Cameron probably wants that to be the transition to the business meeting. Absolutely. I meant to say to the previous speaker that this is all global, what I'm talking about. And so when you say that they might need to increase 70 to 80% in the regions you work in, I think that very well might be the case. I think that it's likely the case. And that the corollary of that is around here in Iowa, we probably don't even need to increase by a quarter to have food be where it, produced where it's going to be consumed and in a place where it can be distributed to the consumers who can actually afford to access it and physically access it.
That's
so.
Exactly what I wanted to make a comment about. And you're very right that a lot of people have loosely used it, they have to double the production. And unfortunately, that has happened just because we need funding. and if you say 26%, by the way, the donors will not get excited, I guess. But the fact is that if you go to some of the regions in the world, South Asia, they are 70 to 100%, and those numbers probably not wrong. So sometimes it's very simplified to say that global waste is 26%, but actually in sub-Saharan Africa, close to 100%.
Absolutely, and at the same time too, you know, this whole line of thinking is not anti-yield. You know, to Adam's question, if we greatly reduce demand, maybe we could accept lower yields, but in most cases, unless it's just a result of extreme intensification of inputs, high yields will be beneficial because they can give us space to achieve some of those other outcomes. I don't want to dominate the whole business meeting, but I think you had a question. Yeah, I think that's a good idea. I don't know what we do to increase our profile since we're brand new.